This is KBOO Portland. It's about 5 o'clock, and now the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Yusuf Al-Jamal on Tuesday, October 29th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. Palestinian journalist, writer, and translator Yusuf Al-Jamal will be speaking on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the conditions facing Palestinian children under Israeli detention. Again, that's An Evening with Yusuf Al-Jamal on Tuesday, October 29th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Portland. This two-day event celebrates the ancient tradition of welcoming back loved ones who have passed on. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. It's a benefit for Transiciones, a program at Mount Hood Community College that has helped Latino women for close to 20 years in reaching their academic and career goals. Again, that's a Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, disability rights Oregon workers are accusing the organization of union busting.
A federal judge has blocked Alabama's controversial abortion ban bill.
And the U.S.'s largest private coal miner, Murray Energy, has filed for bankruptcy.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Nat Moon. The four-day-long Burgerville strike ended on Sunday when the Burgerville Workers Union said management agreed to renegotiate wage contracts, but another strike could be possible. The union and company executives are scheduled to meet for another bargaining session on November 5th, but the workers' union says it's ready to go on strike again if management does not present a better wage offer. In a statement released yesterday, Burgerville said it would not renegotiate wages with the union, but it would be open to discussing the criteria by which employees move up the pay scale. The company is offering a $1 an hour wage increase for employees at all stores. However, workers say that's just an expedited effort to meet state-mandated minimum wage requirements. Management has also claimed that all 41 restaurants remained open during the strike. However, on October 25th, during a protest, the company closed the store's dining room so that it was only serving customers at the drive-thru. The strike's successful disruption of business suggests that the economic impact of the protests could be bigger than the company is letting on. Betty Buchanan, a worker at the Montevilla Burgerville, told Willamette Week, quote, "Burgerville Corporate is not coming to an agreement with us on the contract, and it's been 18 months since we've been fighting this. We're all the backbone of the company. Without us, the company can't run. I'm here to prove a point to all businesses that we have the right to speak our minds and get what we need to be able to survive and not live paycheck to paycheck."
Unionized staff at Disability Rights Oregon are accusing management of union busting amid layoffs. Disability Rights Oregon provides legal aid to Oregonians with disabilities. On September 18th, employees voted unanimously to join the National Organization of Legal Services Workers Union. In a statement released today, the employees are now accusing management of retaliatory layoffs. They allege that on October 21st, about a month after the decision was made to unionize, 7 of their 17 unionized workers received layoff notices. These layoffs would reduce the number of unionized staff to 9. The organization has 25 full-time and 2 part-time employees. 10 are managers and are ineligible for unionization. A statement from the employees read, quote, 2 weeks after union recognition, management demanded emergency bargaining under threat of immediate discretionary layoffs, citing a fiscal emergency. This demand is almost unheard of when opening union negotiations. Management refused to consider other methods of reducing staff expenses, such as mandatory furloughs or a hiring freeze. In another statement, Jan Campbell, president of the organization's board of directors, denied allegations that the layoffs are a method of union busting.
The Battleground Public School Board has voted to overhaul its sexual health education policy, eliminating requirements that the district teach sex ed unless the state of Washington requires it. The school board voted 3-2 on Monday to throw out requirements that the schools teach sex ed. Currently, Washington law only requires that school districts teach about HIV and AIDS prevention. If a school does decide to include sex education in their curriculum, it must be comprehensive and compliant with state standards. However, there is no state law that mandates sexual health education in schools. The Battleground decision ends more than a year of deliberation and discussion on the subject of sexual health education. Some claim that comprehensive sexual health education will promote promiscuity among students. Shauna Walters, who is running for Battleground City Council, has said that she believes external think tanks are using their curriculum to bring, quote, foreign interests of the sex industry. They do not care about respecting our local communities. Rather, they only wish to disrupt our values and corrupt our children. However, previous research published by the Public Library of Science has shown that when sex education in schools is comprehensive, students feel more informed, make safer choices, and have healthier outcomes, resulting in fewer unplanned pregnancies and more protection against sexually transmitted diseases and infection.
The U.S.'s largest private coal miner, Murray Energy, has filed for bankruptcy protection. Murray Energy's bankruptcy has been expected for years. It recently failed to make payments to lenders, and the company entered into a forbearance agreement that bought it time to negotiate a restructuring. However, the grace period came and went, and Murray Energy was unable to pay its bills. S&P Global Ratings downgraded the company's credit rating to default earlier this month. The company also announced it has received $350 million in credit to keep its business operational through bankruptcy. Former Chief Financial Officer Robert Moore will take over as the company's new CEO, replacing Robert Murray. The bankruptcy underscores the pressure facing coal miners, as a string of coal companies have already filed for bankruptcy. The workers also stand to lose, not just jobs, but potentially healthcare and pension benefits. Murray Energy is the last major company contributing to the pension plan of the United Mine Workers of America. The pension plan's depleted funding will only get worse if Murray Energy is relieved of its pension requirements. Power companies are ditching coal as it cannot compete with cheaper natural gas and the plunging cost of solar, wind, and other cleaner alternatives. U.S. power plants are expected to consume less coal next year than at any point since President Jimmy Carter was in the White House.
A federal judge has blocked the controversial Alabama bill that would ban almost all abortions. U.S. District Judge Myron Thompson issued a preliminary injunction barring the Human Life Protection Act from taking effect until the court resolves the case in full. The bill was originally slated to go into effect next month. The judge's decision to block the Alabama bill means that all of the state laws passed this year restricting early state abortions have been blocked from going into effect by the courts. The judge decided that the state's abortion ban, quote, violates the right of an individual to privacy, to make choices central to personal dignity and autonomy, adding that the ban, quote, diminished the capacity of women to act in society and to make reproductive decisions. It defied the United States Constitution. Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall said the ruling was not unexpected, but instead pointed to the bill's underlying aim, overturning the landmark Supreme Court case Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion in the U.S. in 1973. The Alabama bill would also punish doctors who perform abortions with life in prison. The law only allows exceptions to prevent serious health complications to the mother for ectopic pregnancy and if the unborn child has a lethal anomaly, but not for instances of rape or incest. The ACLU and Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit against the bill shortly after it was signed. Both groups cheered today's ruling, saying, quote, "Today's victory means people can still access the health care they need across Alabama for now."
According to an analysis of Trump's federal election spending records, the president's campaign and affiliated political committees have spent about $16.8 million at his businesses since 2016. This is in addition to money spent by the U.S. and foreign governments at properties owned by Trump since he launched his bid for the presidency. Republican political campaigns and PACs have spent just under $1.8 million at Trump-owned businesses just this year. The analysis was carried out by the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, based on spending reports to the Federal Election Commission. Events at Trump businesses create a twofer benefiting the president. When he holds a fundraiser at one of his properties, not only do donors contribute to his campaign, his business collects funds from his campaign for space rental and catering, some of which ultimately ends up in his pocket. According to the center, 48 Republican members of Congress have also spent money at Trump businesses through their campaign and affiliated committees. This spending is only going to grow as Senate Republicans are hosting a two-day Save the Senate retreat at Trump's D.C. hotel early next month. According to the watchdog group, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, room prices during that time are nearly triple the average rate. The most preferred businesses by spenders were Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel, followed by his Florida resort, Mar-a-Lago. In April of 2018, ProPublica reported that campaigns and public expenditures at Trump businesses had already reached $16.1 million. They examined not only campaign spending reports to the FEC, but also state government spending and federal agency expenditure records.
A non-RNC-sponsored Republican primary debate and how lower polling candidates think about their poll numbers as the DNC lessens the debate field with even harsher restrictions. That and more in today's edition of 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
It's very simple. We have to put a price on carbon upstream. The other thing I say here is that the Democrats are off base.
That's former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, candidate for the Republican nomination.
When they talk about how much they're going to spend, they don't talk about putting a price on carbon, which will allow the market to lower the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Weld wants a market-driven approach to climate change and the extreme weather conditions it's caused, like the windstorms and wildfires in California, that Governor Gavin Newsom called, quote, the new normal. The fires and power cuts come on the heels of the Trump administration's long-expected official withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, which started last week. But at a Forbes-hosted debate in Detroit yesterday, President Trump's three Republican challengers all said they want action on climate change. It was the first time Weld, former South Carolina Representative Mark Sanford, and former Illinois Representative Joe Walsh faced off. President Trump was invited, but declined to debate his primary competition. Walsh and Weld made their support for impeachment clear, but Sanford hasn't changed his earlier position. He still thinks the president's fate in Washington should be decided at the ballot box, though he does support a balance of powers.
Whether it's a Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter the party, the idea of oversight is necessary by the Congress and important. What you can't do is, and this is what's done too many times, is there's extreme oversight of the opposite party and that's it.
The Republican National Committee won't be having any debates, but so far, the non-affiliated GOP debate hosts don't have any participation criteria for the three current challengers. But to winnow its 18-candidate field, the Democratic National Committee continues to raise the stakes, both in polling thresholds and number of campaign contributors. 9 Democrats have already qualified for next month's debate, but only 3 so far for December's. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and former Vice President Joe Biden, whose campaign is spending more than it's taking in. The campaign recently changed its position to begin accepting super PAC donations and exhorted their top money raisers to, quote, dig deep in seeking funds in a confidential memo obtained by the New York Times. Former HUD Secretary Julian Castro is also pressed for campaign cash, though he questions how much polling really matters at this stage.
There are a lot of people in these polls who say that they haven't made their mind up. And what's true today is that 3 months is probably 10 lifetimes in politics. Things change so quickly these days.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker notes that early frontrunners don't always come in first.
We're not going to peak in October. We're not going to peak in November. We don't want to win those months. We want to win February caucus day, and we got to build towards that.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a chilly low of 31 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 53 degrees. Today in history, in 1929, the stock market crashed on Black Tuesday. Billions of dollars were lost and stock tickers ran hours behind because the machinery could not handle the tremendous volume of trading. In the aftermath, the world spiraled downward into the Great Depression. The quote of the day is from Genevan philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who said, quote, "You forget that the fruits belong to all and that the land belongs to no one."
The House is set to take the next step in the impeachment process. A voting rights fight is underway in Florida courts, and more with the Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. I'm Dan Hyman. Leaders in the U.S. House say they expect to approve a formal plan to move forward with the impeachment process. Speaker Nancy Pelosi scheduled that vote for Thursday. The White House is refusing to comply with subpoenas, saying in part, without a formal vote, it doesn't have to. Several administration officials and others close to President Donald Trump are refusing to testify. A wildfire near West Los Angeles has consumed more than 600 acres. Evacuation from that fire clogged a major freeway yesterday. Farther north in California, the Kincade Fire is now reportedly twice the size of San Francisco. The U.S. and El Salvador have agreed to let some Salvadorian migrants stay here at least for another year. The U.S. granted the Salvadorians temporary protected status after an earthquake, but had publicly announced a plan to revoke the TPS status. A court victory is giving a boost to voting rights advocates in Florida. Voters approved a constitutional amendment to give 1.4 million former felons the ballot last year. But the legislature has thrown up a hurdle to that. Now the issue looks headed to the state Supreme Court.
A federal judge ruled the state can't deny the right to vote simply because a person can't afford to pay their court fines. After voters approved Amendment 4, a Republican-controlled legislature added restrictions, arguing that all fines and restitution amounts should be paid to complete a person's sentence. Nancy Abudu, with the Southern Poverty Law Center, says the new law is causing confusion because the state doesn't really know how many people have fines pending.
And the state has even acknowledged that they don't know. And that's the reason why one of the claims in the case has to do with the confusing process or nature of this law.
I'm Tramell Gomes.
Kentucky takes in less in revenue than it gives out in tax breaks each year. Public employees there say the state will have to look at the corporate loopholes and giveaways to deal with its badly underfunded public pensions. More from Nadia Ramlagan.
Captain Brian O'Neill is a firefighter in Louisville. He says he's troubled by the ongoing push to chip away at pension benefits.
I'm working alongside of other firefighters that are doing the same job that I am, that are taking the same risks that I am, but just based on when you were hired, you have a very different benefit structure.
According to a study by the Policy Center Good Jobs First, in Kentucky, about $580 million per year are lost to corporate subsidies, tax breaks, and the use of offshore tax havens. Lawmakers and Governor Matt Bevin remain at an impasse on the pension funding issue.
This is PNS. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has reluctantly agreed to extend the Brexit deadline again after failing to get Parliament to agree to his plan to leave the EU by Thursday. Johnson has called for an election ahead of the new deadline, January 31st. The Hill newspaper reports that a Kurdish agent was key to the mission that killed ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, providing intelligence ahead of the raid that included the layout of Baghdadi's compound and even a blood sample. The New York Times is reporting that the U.S. took two prisoners and what they call a trove of intelligence clues in the action. The Belgian Malinois military dog injured in that raid is reportedly still in that combat theater and is expected to recover fully. California K-12 schools have far too few teachers and support personnel, and the kids' education is suffering, according to a new report.
Researchers compared a typical high school with similar schools in two other states and found the student-teacher ratio is 30 to 1 here, but 20 to 1 in Illinois and 11 to 1 in New Jersey. Terrell Burdett, a first-grade teacher from Lancaster, says California teachers are overwhelmed.
Now some of our schools have 33 first graders and no instructional aid. We have no planning time, zero.
Schools in better funded states have more instructional aides, librarians, counselors, coaches, music, arts, and technology teachers, and extracurricular programs. I'm Suzanne Potter.
With bias crimes on the rise and 1 year after a tragic shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue, Maryland's Education Department has announced it will be expanding instruction on the Holocaust at public schools.
Howard Lidbit is the executive director of the Baltimore Jewish Council. For years, he says, Jewish leaders have been concerned that the state's curriculum guidelines on Holocaust lessons have been too vague.
U.S. history high school standards only talked about the Holocaust in the context of the U.S. response to it and immigration policy. The state education standard ought to be much more specific, much more explicit.
The 2018 Holocaust Knowledge and Awareness Study found that two-thirds of millennials who took the survey can't identify what the concentration camp Auschwitz was. And with about 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust, over 4 in 10 millennials believe that just 2 million Jews or fewer were killed. I'm Diane Bernard reporting.
Even LeBron James can't escape those California wildfires. The LA Lakers star tweeted yesterday that he and his family had to evacuate their home, so it seems even King James can't argue with a raging inferno. I'm Dan Hyman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Access to menstruation products continues to be an issue facing women and menstruators across the nation. For those without sufficient financial resources, a period can mean missing school or work, or even having to decide between purchasing a meal or buying hygiene products to address their period. The nonprofit, Period the Menstrual Movement, was started in Portland by Nadia Okamoto, and this month, the organization celebrated National Period Day. KBOO's Claire Rosciato has this story.
On Saturday, October 19th, it was the first celebration of National Period Day. This celebratory day started because of the efforts of the organization Period the Menstrual Movement, founded in Portland by Nadia Okamoto, who started the nonprofit to raise awareness about women and menstruators living in poverty who do not have access to menstruation products. To date, the organization has over 500 chapters across the globe and has provided period products to hundreds of thousands of women and people around the world. And on October 19th, Portland was just one of many cities to take part in this rally. There were several speakers who each had their own message to share with the crowd, including Zoe Chamberlain, the service director at Period, who spoke of the ways in which we as a society fall short in providing equal and affordable access for Period products.
We as a nation are facing so many problems, so many egregious injustices. This problem, the problem of people not having access to Period products when their body is literally shedding itself to make space to create something new, this problem is absolutely solvable and something we can make tangible progress towards. So it starts by a few simple steps. Just like Ashwarya said, first step is eliminating the discriminatory tax that is added to menstrual products, also known as the tampon tax, that classifies them as a luxury item. Now, I don't know about the rest of you menstruators out there, but the last thing I feel in my period is luxurious. This still exists in 35 states. And generally speaking, menstruators typically make less overall in their lifetime than non-menstruators. So that begs the question, why are we forced to pay an additional mandatory tax during a time that's certainly not optional for us? So our second step to correcting this problem is providing freely accessible products in all schools, all shelters, and all prisons. And when I say all, I do mean all. I don't mean just women's bathrooms, women's prisons, women's shelters. This is an inclusive movement where we acknowledge our trans siblings, our gender non-binary siblings, our gender non-conforming siblings. Because this is not just a woman's issue. This is an everybody issue. Because we all know a menstruator, we love a menstruator, or at the very least, we exist because of menstruation. We demand these things because no matter where you live, where you worship, where you work, you deserve to be healthy and safe and have access to the basic products that your body requires to continue the human race.
The event even brought in the attention of 2020 mayoral candidate Sarah Iannarone, who shared her own experience of what it is like being someone who menstruates in the local political arena, competing against those who don't have to worry about getting their period during the campaign trail, or even on stage at a debate.
So I don't get nervous a lot, but I gotta tell you, I'm a little bit nervous because I'm gonna share a period story with you today that I haven't shared publicly before. I don't know how many politicians are out here talking about getting their periods in embarrassing places. So, and I know this is being filmed, it'll be shown, you know, again and again, especially if I get elected. But in 2016, I was running for mayor. I'm doing it again because the same person is mayor and running again, and I think that we need a different person in that office. Here we go. But as you may have noticed, there's an awful lot of mayoral debates that go on, and I participated in over 36 of them. And right in the middle of one of them, I got my period. You know that feeling? Where you sneeze or cough and the gush comes and you're like, oh, you know what? I'm gonna bleed through my clothes and everyone's gonna see it and it's gonna be completely embarrassing. And there were TV cameras there and I was the only person who menstruates on stage. And so I didn't really have the courage at the time to say, hey, I need to take a break, go use the restroom. Take care of this. So I tucked my leg underneath myself and propped myself up to make sure that none of my blood would get onto my clothes and I could stand up and hopefully get out of the event without getting covered in blood. I'm telling you that because in that moment, I knew that bleeding and having my period every month menstruating is part of what makes me, right? It's what makes me strong. It's what makes me capable. It's what makes me able to win a mayoral debate on public safety, even though I'm about to bleed right through my dress. It gives me courage, right? It gives us courage. It teaches us patience. It teaches us empathy. It teaches us to care for each other. I remember teaching my best friend when she got her period how to use her first tampon because her mom had never taught her. And it helps us come together, I think, in that shared experience of people who menstruate monthly, and then as we stop menstruating, we come together in that shared experience too. Although I can laugh about this now, at the time it was pretty difficult for me to deal with that. It affected me through the rest of that race because I always felt like I had to be on guard for the unexpected. And as horrifying as it was for me at the time, I knew that my experience of that potential embarrassment, of that inconvenience was going to be short-lived because I have access to period products every month. I don't go short. The women that I'm engaging with in the streets, especially women experiencing homelessness, they have a very difficult time, not only getting access to period products, but then disposing of period products. Having your period while you're living on the streets is a very challenging experience. And so, understanding that we need to help each other bleed with dignity, I think, is important.
One speaker traveled all the way from Pakistan to Portland just to share her story as a disabled woman who menstruates and how her own experience led to starting her own business called Girly Things, which provides access to period products. Here is Tanzila Khan.
I'm Tanzila Khan from Pakistan, and I have made a deliberate move to be here to tell all of you that you're not alone. I bring with me lots of love, support, solidarity all the way from Pakistan. We need initiatives like these to connect menstruators and non-menstruators across the world. You see, some people think period is a problem, but it's not a problem. It's a sign of health. It's a sign that our bodies are healthy. When I started my period, of course, as a menstruator with a disability, my family was worried. How will she handle it? Will she be fine? Will she know? But I was not worried. I was celebrating inside because I knew that now I can be a mother. And when I have a daughter, I'm going to tell her that periods are nothing to be ashamed of. It's a sign of health, and it should be celebrated every time we bleed. Now, I am a very busy person in Pakistan. I love to run around and get things done. I love to seize the day. That is my passion. And my ambitions vary from education to environment to health to disability rights in Pakistan. And one day when I was running across on the roads, hopping from one meeting to the other, I knew I had to get the day sorted. I had to buy bread, I had to pick laundry. I started my period out of nowhere. And I thought, okay, Tanzila, you've got this, you'll be fine. But that day, I could not find a single wheelchair accessible shop in my own city. And that's when it struck me that we are still a very long way to go to make sure that we have healthcare and feminine hygiene products available to menstruators. And I thought, not to worry, sister is here. So I went home, I counted my money, the money I had to use to go for my master's. But I said, no, I think this is something that we need right now. And I have to play my tiny tad bit. So we started this platform called girlythings.pk. It's a website and it's a mobile application. And through which we deliver feminine hygiene products from sanitary napkins to tampons to toilet seat covers to women at their doorstep. And also in public, once menstruators start period out of nowhere because of stress and hormonal changes, they lose their confidence at workplaces. And we can't afford that. We need menstruators on the table to make sure that we're part of every decision making that is happening. And when that happens, and if the menstruator starts the period, we deliver an urgent menstrual kit to them right there within 40 minutes to make sure that they can still go on and seize the day.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBOO Evening News.
Keystone XL pipeline water use hearings are underway in South Dakota. The Hopi tribe opposes a hydroelectric proposal in northern Arizona, and street signs around Bade-Makaska Lake now reflect the Dakota name. With those stories and more, it's National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The South Dakota Water Management Board is hearing three more days of arguments for and against water use for the Keystone XL pipeline project. Those hearings start Tuesday in Pierre. Permit requests come from TC Energy and landowners to host pipe yards and worker camps. A two-day hearing was held earlier this month. The second round is scheduled to last through Thursday. Victoria Wicks has more.
South Dakota law sets up criteria for granting water use permits. There is likely enough unappropriated water available, the proposed diversion won't unlawfully impair existing rights, and the proposed use is beneficial and serves a public interest. In the first 2 days of the water hearings, DENR engineer Mark Rath said he recommended that the permits be granted because his studies showed the quantity of water exists, including in the White River. Rath agreed that he also had the obligation to make sure water was not already being appropriated by communities that rely on it, and other consumers' rights to it are not violated. Those concerns led to questions from Peter Capicella, the attorney representing the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and the Great Plains Tribal Water Alliance.
Are you aware that there are Rosebud tribal lands and tribal communities in Millett and Tripp counties today?
Yes.
Are you aware that there are thousands of acres of Rosebud tribal and allotted lands today that abut the White River in the area of the point of diversion?
I don't know that.
Are you aware that there are Rosebud tribal communities in Tripp County in close proximity to the White River? Current day tribal communities?
No.
Still to be answered in these hearings is whether tribes have first rights to the water under the Winters Doctrine. TC Energy, through its objections, has indicated those rights don't exist if the tribes have not established and documented a baseline quantification for water use. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Hopi tribe has weighed in against a large hydroelectric proposal in northern Arizona that would construct 4 dams near the Grand Canyon. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports the area is among the tribe's most culturally significant areas.
In a letter written to federal officials last week, Hopi leaders say the proposal is, quote, simply unacceptable and would forever adversely impact Hopi sacred places. The Grand Canyon is home to many sacred sites for the Hopi, as well as other southwestern tribes like the Zuni and Havasupai. Hopi officials say they specifically oppose any development near the confluence of the Colorado and Little Colorado Rivers. Clark Tanakongva is the Hopi vice chairman.
It's being proposed not too far from what Hopi calls their place of emergence to this world, called the Sipapuni. This is something that should be left protected. If it was to be flooded, it would be just like flooding the Vatican.
The Hopi tribe also says the project would violate the 2006 Intergovernmental Compact with the Navajo Nation that allowed both tribes to access millions of disputed acres for spiritual practice. The proposal by the Phoenix Company Pumped Hydro Storage on a section of the Little Colorado on the Navajo Nation would build 4 dams and 4 reservoirs. A preliminary application was accepted by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but doesn't allow the company to disturb or enter the area. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The city of Minneapolis, Minnesota, replaced nearly 24 street signs around Bidet-McCoska Lake this week to reflect the lake's Dakota name. While the Native community supports the move, a lawsuit is challenging the authority of the state's Natural Resources Department, which changed the lake's name. The City Park Board voted in August to replace street signs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Native American volleyball players from Salt River High School in Mesa, Arizona, were harassed at a game against a charter school in Phoenix's northern suburbs. According to witnesses, the game began respectfully as both teams vied for a spot in the quarterfinals of their league tournament. But then, one player from the Salt River team, who are all Native American, dove for the ball and missed it. A group of boys in the crowd seized upon the opportunity and began mocking the team by imitating Native American dances, war cries, and yelling, quote, savages. The taunting got so bad that the Salt River coach called off the match in the middle of the fourth set to ensure the players' safety. Arizona has one of the largest concentrations of Native Americans in the U.S., but those communities are regularly on the receiving end of hatred and bigotry. Even worse, they are often ignored as they try to seek justice. Early on, parents approached officials from the Canyon Athletic Association, the league's governing body, concerning the slurs and gestures. In response, the referee told them, quote, boys will be boys. After the coach stopped the match, officials held a phone conference and an in-person meeting to determine what exactly had transpired, but no conclusion was made. The match was eventually rescheduled for Friday at a neutral location where the other school ended up defeating Salt River as security guards looked on. Tate Walker, a spokesperson for Salt River Schools, said, quote, Tuesday's events go beyond one volleyball game and are indicative of systemic discrimination problems that are difficult for many to acknowledge across the education landscape, especially when it's so much easier to claim ignorance. There are more conversations to be had.
There is a state of emergency in California amid massive wind-driven wildfires. Massachusetts sues ExxonMobil over climate fraud, and a poll finds that Americans want less oil and gas exploitation. All that and more on today's Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen.
It's Tuesday, October 29, 2019.
It's about dog-eat-dog capitalism meeting climate change. It's about corporate greed meeting climate change.
State of emergency in California amid massive wind-driven wildfire outbreak. Massachusetts sues ExxonMobil over climate fraud. Plus,
we're protecting the oil. We're securing the oil.
Trump's plan to take Syria's oil has a small problem. It violates international law.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Trump says he will send federal aid for the fires, but first we have to come up with some dirt on Joe Biden. So that's...
Damn it. I knew it. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, California Governor Gavin Newsom had some pretty strong words for the utility companies that are shutting down power for customers all over the state of California last week.
Oh my, yes, he did. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a statewide state of emergency with upwards of 600 fires burning across the state. Firefighters are struggling to contain them, from the massive wind-driven Kincaid Fire north of San Francisco to the new Getty Fire in Los Angeles. As we go to air, no deaths have been reported, but over the weekend, more than 200,000 people were under mandatory evacuation orders. Air quality is hazardous in affected areas. An estimated 3 million people have had their power shut off at various times to prevent fires ignited by downed electrical wires during this historic wind event. 43 of the state's 58 counties over the weekend were under high wind red flag warnings. The intentional power outages have hampered communications by knocking out cell phone towers, crippled city water pumping stations, and forced the cancellations of classes at schools and universities. More extreme wind events are in the forecast for this week. Governor Newsom has repeatedly emphasized that while climate change is the primary driver of California's explosive wildfire seasons, investor-owned utilities also bear a responsibility, specifically Pacific Gas and Electric, which courts have found deferred required maintenance on its aging equipment, even as it paid billions to shareholders and executives.
Well, of course, which part of for-profit companies are you unclear on?
I will forgive them the new realities and the acuity of a climate crisis of which we are feeling its impacts perhaps more than any other state in the nation. But I will not forgive them for not making the kind of investments in their equipment, hardening and undergrounding, and anticipating this new reality of which they have had ample time to anticipate.
California has warmed 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970. The area burned by wildfires has increased 500% over that time. The widespread disruptions, according to former California Governor Jerry Brown in an interview with Politico, are a warning sign for all Americans of what could be in store in a climate-changed future.
Well, let me just say it again. The state of California needs to take over these for-profit power companies that have failed the state so miserably.
Meanwhile, in the nation's capital,
we're securing the oil.
President Trump, in a news conference on Sunday, announcing that a U.S. military operation in Syria had resulted in the death of the leader of the Islamic State, said that some U.S. troops will remain in Syria after all.
We are leaving soldiers to secure the oil. Now, we may have to fight for the oil. That's okay. Maybe somebody else wants the oil, in which case they have a hell of a fight. We should be able to take some also.
So the President of the United States still does not know that the United States has no legal claim to Syria's oil and that pillaging any natural resources of another nation is a violation of both U.S. law and international law, specifically the Geneva Conventions.
Why should Donald Trump care any more about international laws than he does about our own national laws?
Excellent question, unless perhaps later he cares about war crimes.
Doubt it.
In other news, after a four-year investigation, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey has filed suit against oil giant ExxonMobil, accusing the company of defrauding investors with its financial disclosures, misleading the public, and violating the state's consumers through deceptive advertising about the role its fossil fuel products play in causing climate change, and for threatening the world economy through its actions. Exxon is already on trial in New York over similar allegations that it misled investors by hiding material risks to its business from climate change. Finally, some good news.
I thought that Exxon story was good news.
A new public opinion poll conducted by the Washington Post finds that a large majority of Americans want to reduce oil and gas exploration rather than increase it, in direct contradiction to President Trump's drill everywhere agenda. More than 8 in 10 respondents said drilling in the United States should either decrease or stay as it is, and more than 50% want oil and gas exploration reduced on public lands and offshore.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Hundreds of lots in Baltimore, Maryland have been transformed into usable green space. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In some areas of Baltimore, Maryland, the streets are lined with abandoned, boarded-up houses. Lisa McNeely, the city's director of sustainability, says decades of population decline are partly to blame.
And beyond that, in part due to the disinvestment in many of our predominantly African-American neighborhoods, we have a deteriorated housing stock. And that means that we've had to demolish some of those buildings, and so we have vacant lots.
So Baltimore is converting some of those lots into usable green space. As part of its Adopt a Lot program, residents clean and maintain hundreds of vacant lots. Some are now urban gardens or open spaces where communities can gather. The goal is to help revitalize some of the city's underserved neighborhoods. But McNeely says adding green space and planting trees can also help cool neighborhoods. That's increasingly important as Baltimore summers get hotter.
We know that certainly for large green areas, you can see that the temperatures are lower and that any place where you have tree canopy is an improvement.
So transforming vacant lots can improve residents' quality of life even as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The European frogbit is an attractive water plant that is a ruthless invader. With more on this story, it's CurrentCast.
A bit about European frogbit on this CurrentCast. European frogbit may look beautiful, like tiny white water lilies floating on the edges of ponds and slow-moving rivers, but this plant is a ruthless invader. Frogbit was brought to Canada in 1932 as an ornamental pond plant, but it's now spread to places such as the bays and marshes of Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, and tributaries to the St. Lawrence River. It forms dense mats that shut out light for the vegetation below. It also leaves little room for ducks and wildlife to move, not to mention that it hinders boating, fishing, and swimming. If it's stuck to your boat, frogbit can jump to new areas, so clean, drain, and dry your vessel before launching somewhere new. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Ted Jones. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Nat Moon.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I am Nicole Martin, the host of KBOO's Threshold Shift program, and today I had the treat of interviewing Simrit Kaur. She is an ethereal wave neo-psychedelic world beat artist who is currently on tour and will be arriving in Portland on Tuesday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. with a show at the First Congressional UCC over on Southwest Park Avenue. Welcome to KBOO. I also know that you have a new album coming out in November.
The name is When We Return. Yeah, it could be maybe the third week of November, so we will set that date pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, yeah, the albums are released, pre-released on this tour right now.
And I know that a lot of your other albums have also hit number one on iTunes charts, as well as placed really highly globally, you know, on the Billboard charts as well. So I've been digging into your backstory a little bit, and I know that you were born in Athens, Greece, and began growing up there and then moved to the States.
Yeah, I was adopted. I was an orphan for 2 years in Athens, and I was born to a mother who was a well-known singer at the time in Greece, and she was, and she's still a well-known singer there. I just met her last year, and it was really, really a neat kind of full circle experience for me and her. But yeah, she's only 16 years older than me, and she was a touring musician and was pregnant with me and, you know, just wasn't supported by her family to have a child at that age. Her own mother had just given birth to a child. And so it just turned out that, you know, I was an orphan for 2 years and was adopted into the United States to another Greek family, by another Greek family. And it was really fortunate for me that I was raised in my own culture and a strong, rich Greek culture. I think that was really fortunate for me and my brother, who was also adopted from a different Greek family in Greece. So we were raised in our tradition and learning how to cook and read and write and speak and steeped in the Greek music from the time we were really young, and we Greek danced from the time we were really young, and we sang in the Greek church choir, so we were singing these thousands-year-old ancient hymns that were just so amazing, and those melodies, those minor, like, darker, you know, mystical melodies, they have a real strong influence on how I write today and the things that I tend to lean towards as far as melodic sensibilities and things like that. So, yeah, you know, being Greek has really influenced me a lot in my life, and being raised in a culture for sure. Being raised in the South, you know, being Southern for most of my life also influenced me. So, yeah, I had a really interesting upbringing, and yeah, I'm really grateful for the way I was raised and the things that I experienced.
I'm interested in how your writing and your collaborative process in terms of, you know, when these sonic layers come in and how you want to orchestrate your songs, because a lot of them are incredibly lush, and in listening to them, it's like, oh, that
cello almost sounds like a Tuvan horsehead fiddle. And I know that you've traveled extensively. So just wondering how your collaborative process goes with writing. Is it something where it just comes about in your mind and then you find the musicians to match? Or is this something where everybody's kind of writing stuff and bringing things to the table?
You know, what normally happens is I bring a song with the melody, the arrangement, the lyrics, everything like that. And when I say the arrangement, I'm not saying each individual, like, orchestrated part, even though I can hear that sometimes. But I'll bring the skeleton of the arrangement to my band, and we'll practice, and everyone will bring their parts. You know, they'll come up with some parts. And even though the arrangement is there, and so that means, like, oh, okay, now we're going to go into this part where we sustain this note for this long. But they decide, oh, what are they going to play in that part, that kind of thing. You know, and there's times where I'm like, I have to hear this kind of drum beat in a song. It has to sound like this. But otherwise, I really, really like to hear what my bandmates bring, because we've all been playing together for years, and they're a huge part of the sound for me. I don't look elsewhere to get sound from other people to bring in, unless it's something like, you know, an organ, like a Hammond B3 that's on this album, that we had a musician come in and play that who's, you know, masterful at that instrument. We had a violinist come in for two songs. But other than that, it's just the five of us in the band that are playing on the album. And so there's two songs on the album, Just a Glance and also It Is Written, that my bandmate, Felice Amakora, brought the melodic, his melodic parts, at least on the Cora, and brought like an A part and a B part, and then he brought it to me, and he and I would work on it together, and then we brought it to the whole band. And and those two songs both also had lyrics to them. They were lyrics from different kinds of poetry from antiquity, so he was inspired and brought those to the table, and we co-wrote those and then presented that to the band, and again the band did their thing with it, and that's basically how it goes. It's all intentional. It's a thing. It's a journey. Some songs don't stop because there's interludes that connect them, and those kind of things happen often when we're practicing a lot together and we have time to stretch out and try things out and things like that.
It sounds like you all have a lot of fun together.
It's like the most fun thing for me to do is to play music. So I love it, obviously, and, you know, that's why I'm willing to do the work, but it does take a lot of work as being a woman in the industry, and I just always remember, like, I love to play music, and this is why I'm here. It's healing and fun, and I always feel better after I play, and I always feel great when I'm playing, and, yeah, I just focus on that, and I do things the way I like to do them, and when comments and criticisms come my way, I just focus on the vision and I focus on my own intuition with it. And that's really taken me pretty far as like in my own career. So I would really suggest that to anyone doing it themselves, is listening to your intuition, but always having people around you that are real with you. They're not just yes people. That can be pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
Sure, I do my best. By any means, I don't ever feel like what I'm doing is the end all, and I never feel like I'm a master of any of that kind of stuff. It's just I'm sharing my knowledge. I had, you know, a lot of challenges growing up, and I also had a beautiful upbringing. It's not like it was like all hard and challenging, but I did. I mean, I was an orphan for 2 years. I could have a bitterness about myself, you know, and I don't think that is, like, who benefits from that? I certainly don't. No one else does. And, you know, I feel like it's really important. Like, we need to uplift each other. There's so much in the world right now. There's a lot of things that are needing our attention so that we can help to shift those things. But at the same time, I mean, we need to uplift each other and share hope with each other and share some positivity with each other and share some tools that will actually help us to get in that space. Cause I think it's extremely easy to stay in a very, depressed state. And it's just such a common thing. And, man, if there's something that someone can do for 5 to 10 minutes a day that could really enhance the quality of them, their lives and the way that they experience themselves, like, why not share those things?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By actually starting to do this, you are sort of challenging yourself to find out where you're at and where you were and where you want to go, which is the work, at least in my opinion, that, you know, you were kind of speaking to, of doing the work, finding out who you are and what you want to be putting out into the world. So that's all very cool, and thank you so much for doing that. The album When We Return will be dropping in mid-November, but there are pre-sales happening now.
That's going to be on iTunes and all of the digital platforms.
So the show is again Tuesday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the First Congressional UCC here in Portland. There are still tickets available.
Yeah, you can go to simritkaurmusic.com to buy tickets.
Spelled S-I-M-R-I-T-K-A-U-R.
It's going to be a really beautiful show. It's going to be super fun, and we're really looking forward to it. It's a beautiful venue with a gorgeous pipe organ, and yeah, I'm really excited about it. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you, and we will see you Tuesday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m., First Congressional UCC.
Awesome. See you there.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Preference with your host, Hedda.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studio in Portland. Educata Ya hosts Dia de los Muertos featuring decorative altars, people dressed up as Katrinas, reading of the satirical Calaveras, and a traditional Pan de Muerto. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studios, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series,